It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, with Thanksgiving comes, if you're lucky, some new traditions, like our Year of the Naked Bird. We just moved to Denver, and we were adopted by our neighbors, the Goodman family. Well, my husband was innocently carving the turkey until the Goodman women descended to practice their family tradition. That was, strip the bird bare and nibble up every bit of roasted skin. He was roaring in shock, they were roaring in laughter, and so the Feast of the Naked Bird was initiated. Not a magazine cover moment. Stick around for much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This podcast is supported by Shutterstock.com, offering 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips to take creative projects to the next level. 25% off new accounts at Shutterstock.com. Offer code SPLENDID1113. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. But whether we like it or not, we're heading into the high season of family and friends. So we thought it might be a good time to check in with our friend Mo Rocca. Now, he's someone I consider to be a perpetual student of life. That social commentator with a sort of a round-the-bend take on what he sees. You hear it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, in his appearances on CBS, and in his cooking channel series, My Grandmother's Ravioli. Mo, it's good to have you back.
Well, great to be here with you, Len.
You know, I'm just thinking, Thanksgiving, you know, has all these wonderful pieces to it, but there's also, well, kind of the odd sides to it. So standing back and looking at Thanksgiving as we celebrate it now, what's your take on it?
Well, you know, I think about all the twists that people keep adding to Thanksgiving, all the recipe. You keep hearing about a twist on asparagus, you know, Ina's twist on creamed corn, Paula's twist on gravy. You know, I want to bring a twist to the whole holiday itself. I want to put a twist on Thanksgiving because I think that what happens at all holidays is there's a lot of compartmentalization that goes on. And I kind of want to compartmentalize Thanksgiving and split it in two. And this is an idea that I haven't tried yet, but I'd like to, which is to do two separate meals. And there's a reason for this. So what I would do is on Thanksgiving Eve, the night before Thanksgiving, I would assemble all the friends and family that I love but maybe not love as much as other family and friends and have a traditional Thanksgiving dinner for them. I don't like watching football, for instance. So that dinner would have football. We could lobby the NFL or maybe college football to have a Thanksgiving Eve game. Or if they couldn't do that, maybe I could just play a recorded game from last year.
Yeah.
And then the next day for the actual Thanksgiving, I would have the other friends and family, the people that that I also love. Maybe I don't want to say I love more, but I'd bring them together. And for that, we could have leftovers because I love leftovers. And we would watch Meet Me in St. Louis because I really like that. I prefer that at Thanksgiving over football. And it would be much more of a standing Thanksgiving. I'm not a big fan of sitting at a table for long periods of time. I get bed sores. I mean, it starts to hurt after a while. So this is what I would do. That would be my twist on Thanksgiving.
I think this is, I think this makes a lot of sense. And the leftovers are the best part of the meal.
Well, they're more flavorful, right? I mean, there was and you can tell me, doesn't something chemical happen where it becomes more savory, it becomes creamier and
– Yeah. There must be something chemical that happens because it always tastes better the next day. Yeah, Thanksgiving is also kind of a marker, a personal marker. You know, I keep thinking about when I was much younger, it was, this time last year is when I broke up with so-and-so, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, every Thanksgiving is like a 25th high school reunion. I mean, it's you're evaluating yourself against where you were, against other people. I think holidays are really best, of course, with kids, with little kids. I don't have little kids, so I'd love to go out and get some for Thanksgiving. And I don't know if there's any way to do that. I mean, people can maybe lend me their children.
Well, they don't go through that in the same way that adults do. They don't do that last year, I remember.
Yeah, that would – no, exactly. No, the 4-year-old girl is not taking a drag on her cigarette thinking of what might have been. And if she is, I mean, that's – well, that kid needs a series.
What do you think about the turkey obsession, making the perfect turkey?
Well, I'm a fan of side dishes. I mean, I actually much prefer side dishes. I don't get the fixation with turkey. I mean, it's a good durable meat, but I much prefer little side dishes. I was somebody in college. If I could do college over again, I'd only take electives. I wouldn't have a major. And that's how I feel about Thanksgiving. I much prefer the little side dishes. You know, the cranberry sauce, the molasses biscuits, you know, the peas, the twist on mashed potatoes. There are a lot of them, I suppose.
Right.
But the turkey, I feel like, I mean, I suppose the center would not hold if you did not have turkey. You need to have it. Maybe you need to have it so that you can have something to put the side dishes around. I mean, if we were going to untwist Thanksgiving and bring it back to the beginning, I mean, didn't they eat muskrat and maize or something? What did they actually eat at the first Thanksgiving?
They probably had muskrat. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's an easy out. You can blame history. You can use history as your scapegoat and say, well, they didn't have turkey, at the first Thanksgiving. Then serve whatever meat you find in your backyard.
Right. And you could have a turkey right in the center of the table like a bouquet.
Well, that's nice. I actually like that. It's basically a centerpiece. That's what a turkey is. It's the centerpiece.
But, one of the things I was looking at was new trends, this year, because every year I have to come up with a turkey recipe and that kind of thing. And I thought you might get a kick out of this because here are some of the things I found. Number one, the new trend is a turkey cupcake. Where essentially you make turkey meatloaf, you put it in a cupcake thing, you bake it, and then you frost it with mashed potatoes, and instead of a cherry on top, you put cranberry sauce. And I was thinking that you might find that interesting.
Well, I do find it interesting, but I'm actually sort of anti-cupcake. I think one of the reasons is I think that there is an aversion to intimacy that has led us down the cupcake path. I mean, whatever happened to the days of cake when everyone was sharing a cake? And so I'm not sure how I feel about these turkey cupcakes. I mean, of course I have to try one now, or I have to at least see one. But shouldn't we all be eating from the same tray of slop?
I hadn't thought about that piece to the cupcake phenomena. It's separating us. I hadn't thought about that.
It is separating us. It's like – it's very like – it sounds, with all due respect, like a very L.A. thing. People are used to being in their cars, being separated from others. But in New York, where we all take the subway, we are not going to be eating turkey cupcakes. We are all going to be sharing our turkey meatloaf out of the same tin on the F train with strangers. I am – by the way, I have to say that it's a little disingenuous of me to say that because Thanksgiving is supposed to be a time of sharing. And I do have a line when it comes to sharing. I can share anything but wet desserts. I have a real hard time sharing wet desserts. It feels so intimate. So I can share an apple pie, but I can't share the mode. I can't do that.
I see. The ice cream is not going to be shared.
Yeah. It's just – it's too intimate.
But, Mo, thank you. This is making our Thanksgiving. And you have a great one.
Thank you. When I see you next, I'm going to make you a mashed potato and gravy parfait.
Oh, I love it. This is great. You have a great Thanksgiving, and thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Happy Thanksgiving.
Mo Rocca's TV series, My Grandmother's Ravioli, can be seen on the Cooking Channel. Well, we're here today to solve the endless debate. What is the best part of the holiday bird? Well, while you argue over thigh versus breast, wings versus legs, I'm turning to Frances Lamb for the last word. Frances is a food writer, an editor at Clarkson Potter, and a judge on Top Chef Masters. But most importantly, he's a man who really cooks. Francis, nice to have you back.
Thank you for that introduction, Lynn.
Well, you are more than welcome. But where do you stand on this debate?
You know, I think the whole conversation misses a key element. And it's not just thigh or breast or wing or leg, but where's the skin? That's my question. Where is the skin with turkey? And one of my problems with turkey is you have this big bird and you have so much meat on the bird, but it's covered by this super thin skin. You never hear about, oh, I love the skin on that, because you don't get any. You get a slice of turkey and you get maybe like a quarter inch strip on the edge of it. So Chef Anthony Mint of Mission Street Food in San Francisco and I were writing back and forth one day, and he said what he likes to do is kind of game the system a little bit. And instead of worry about the turkey skin, he goes out and gets chicken skin. And he might get some from the butcher, or you can even just go buy, you know, those big family packs of chicken thighs or whatever. You have a whole bunch of them.
Right.
You grab all the skin off of that, and you can freeze the thighs and use them later. And what he likes to do is bake them until super crisp, almost like a chip, and just serve them along with the turkey meat.
That's a brilliant idea, because I'm with you. I think the skin, that's where all the flavor is. That's where the lusciousness is. So how does he bake it? What does he do?
Yeah. Oh, it's the easiest thing. I mean, what you do is you take this skin, you salt it a little bit, and you sort of spread it out on a sheet tray, and you leave it in your fridge overnight. And you have to do that because it lets it dry out, basically.
Right.
Then the next day he takes it out, and he sandwiches another sheet tray on top of it just to keep them flat. You keep them all in one layer.
Uh-huh.
And he bakes it in a 300-degree oven for about 40 minutes until they're golden brown and crisp. And you take it out, and you're like, wow, this is the greatest thing on earth. I might just stay in the kitchen with this.
Yeah, right, exactly. How do you resist eating every bit of it before the dinner?
Yeah, that's your real challenge. That's your real challenge with that. And what I actually like to do, I like a different technique. And I make basic chicken cracklings, almost like you would do like with pork skin and pork cracklings.
Uh-huh.
It's a little more involved. It takes more time, and it's a little less foolproof. But I kind of think it's fun because, I don't know, I'm the kind of guy that thinks it's like standing in front of a stove and stirring a pot of chicken skin is fun. and also there is a little bit of a difference in the product. With Anthony's technique of baking it, you get these thin, crisp, again, almost chips.
Right.
And the way I do it, when you're frying it slowly in its own fat, it gets a little airier, and because you cut it, it's a little chunkier and a little bit crunchier. So the way I do it is I'll take all the fat off the skin. If you're using a whole bird, you know, get some of the fat from the tail area. You know, you just get all the loose fat you have lying around.
Right.
You chop it up. You throw it in a heavy pot with a little bit of water and just kind of get it going. The water is just there just to help it melt a little. You're not really doing much with it. This is over pretty low heat, you know, medium low heat. And while the fat is kind of rendering, you just kind of slice the skin into, you know, half inch or quarter inch strips. Not a big deal. You know, you don't have to be super precise about it. And then you throw it into the melting fat, and you kind of stir it up, and it gets warm, and it gets cooked, and you know, it turns kind of gray. It's pretty gross. But you keep stirring it, you know, once in a while, 5-10 minutes, give another stir while you're doing something else. And eventually, you'll start to see the skin kind of want to stick together and kind of get clumpy. And this is when you kind of stir more mercilessly. You want to break it all up because you don't want them all to stay together. And it starts to fry very slowly, very slowly. And eventually, you'll notice a change. And you notice instead of it being all clumpy and sticky, it starts to make a sandpapery kind of sound, like a shh, 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 shh in the pot. And that's the sound of cracklings. That's what you want. So you're doing that, and you just keep frying it slowly until you eventually evaporate all the rest of the water. And then when it's crisp and hot, you just take it out. You strain it. You put a little salt on it, and you can keep it there for a few days even. And what I love to do with that, since it's now in bits, is, you know, instead of putting out the fried onions on the green bean casserole or you use this instead. You use fried chicken skin bits instead.
Oh,
and it's just so out of control.
This is brilliant. Francis, thank you.
Thank you.
You can find Francis Lam's recipe for his magic chicken skin on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all the Thanksgiving menus and recipes. Whether you're a carnivore, flexitarian, vegan, or vegetarian, we have you covered. And that's splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with a lesson in knife wielding and memories of mom. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This podcast is supported by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect image for your next creative project. You can choose from over 28 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips. Images available in any size for one price. Go to Shutterstock.com, use Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could look like, then use offer code SPLENDID1113 for 25% off your first purchase. That's offer code SPLENDID1113. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Nothing like this time of year to bring family into sharp focus. We may not mean to, but we count up the gains and losses and try to make sense out of them. Alex Witchell watched her mother disappear in plain sight. This mother, this smart, loving, ultra-capable woman, was only 70 when the dementia began. Well, Alex was raised to fix what is broken, but fixing was impossible. What was possible was holding on to her mother by love, by humor, and by cooking her mother's dishes. Alex tells this story in her book, All Gone, A Memoir of My Mother's Dementia with Recipes. Sally Swift, our managing producer, talked with Alex.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining us. So tell me about your mother.
Well, my mom was born in the Bronx in 1931. She was the oldest of three children, and she was raised by my grandmother, who was very much about her getting married and having children. That was very important to her. And my mother was very smart, wanted to be a biochemist. And those years, girls weren't allowed to do that in a lot of places. When my mother went to the University of Wisconsin into the biochemistry department, they steered her down the hall to psychology because they said, this is not a field for you. So she became a doctor of educational psychology. She taught at Iona College in New Rochelle, New York for 35 years. And she and my dad still are living in suburban New York. And, I guess I'm glad that I can still see her, even though she does recognize me. But we can't really just have much of a meaningful conversation anymore.
You write about a defining moment with your mom when she was eating with your brother. Can you tell us about that?
They were at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York that day for a bunch of tests, and I was having to report a story. So when I got there, they were having a late lunch just in the waiting room. They were having tuna fish sandwiches, and my mother put down the sandwich, and my brother, without missing a beat, who at that time had a son who I think was maybe 3 or 4, just took a napkin and started wiping her fingers one by one. And it was so shocking to me to see this because my mother was just like the general of the family. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would never think of doing that. And she would never do it to us, you know, past like 2 years old. She'd hand you a napkin and say, wipe your hands. Mm-hmm. But he did it so sort of unconsciously and lovingly because he just understood that she wasn't really in charge of herself in that way. But it was shocking to me to see it. And this introduced the entire idea that's really central in this book of something called ambiguous loss, which is the idea that the person is there but not there. When somebody is sitting in front of you and alive, but you can't engage them directly as the person who they always were, that is a loss. That is a death of sorts. Technically, nothing has changed, but of course everything has changed. But it was that moment of watching my brother wiping her fingers like a child where I thought, oh my God, where am I? Mm-hmm. What is going on here? This is no longer my mother.
Mm-hmm. And you started cooking her recipes as you started to deal with her illness.
Yes. In 1997, I had asked her, she was still herself then, and I had asked her to give me a folder of all of, you know, sort of her greatest hits. And she did. And I kept it on my desk for a while, and I made a few things. But I had the feeling that she would always be available on the other end of the phone for me to call her. And quite frankly, she was still cooking all of that through many years between 1997 and 2005. And I felt like I didn't need to know how to do it. Once she got sick, it made me feel closer to her to make my house smell the same as hers and to follow her directions. I might say that, like most home cooks, what I discovered looking at her recipes was that it wasn't quite the right direction to do. You know, she would say, take half a cup of this, and it turned out to really be a whole cup. And I would call her up, you know, right in the beginning, right before I couldn't talk to her again, and say, what is this? And she would say, well, if you don't like it, do it the way you like. But what comforted me about making her food was that it was her rules and she still was in charge, and it still made me feel like her child, safe in her home, if that makes sense to you.
That makes total sense.
I couldn't reach her in the ways that I always had through conversation, but evoking her that way through her food really kept her close to me, made me feel, you know, like we were still sort of together as a family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because you write in the book about marrying a man with two boys, right? So you become the stepmother, mm-hmm. and you write about how you try out these recipes and the boys would have their favorites that they'd want again and again and again. And in a way, you're, of course, doing the same thing in your new family as you did in your old.
Absolutely. And, you know, the flip side of all that is when you cook for your family, when you cook things for your family that they love, there are certain things. There's a recipe in the book for chicken breasts with rosemary and garlic sauteed in olive oil. That's the kids, my stepchildren's favorite. And my stepchildren, they're now 32 and 28. But they still, when they come home, one of them just came home 3 weeks ago and said, I said, what do you want? And of course, that was the first thing he wanted. The act of cooking those dishes that unify your family is incredibly comforting. When I make that dish, it has its own choreography. I know I start by doing this and then I do that. If you follow a recipe, if you know that sort of pattern of what you're doing, it must be like knitting. I'm not a knitter, but mm-hmm. I see how addictive and comforting it is to people who do it. That act of being in the kitchen, following along with your directions, knowing that once you put it on the table, everyone is so happy and it tastes exactly the way it did last time and they count on that. You know, it's just that element of home cooking really does involve the home.
It's a lovely thing. It's one of life's mysteries, right?
It is.
Alex, it's a beautiful book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Alex Witchell's book is All Gone, a memoir of my mother's dementia with recipes. I have to believe that more people sharpen their knives this month than at any other. We pull out the carving knife once a year. It's sort of the odd bird of the cutlery drawer. It has a distinctive shape, balance, and even thickness that all have been craftily designed to work together for a common purpose. Well, I asked David Leet of Leet's Culinaria to get the skinny on carving knives, and he ended up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, with Corey Milligan, who's the founder of New West Knife Works.
Hey, Corey, it's a pleasure having you here.
Howdy, David. Thanks for having me.
Now, Corey, let's talk about this neglected child of the knife block. Exactly what is a carver?
Well, a carving knife is a knife that's designed for cutting up and slicing meats. Today, we mostly use it to cut up turkeys, but throughout history, it was used to carve any large piece of meat.
And talk to me a little bit about the shape and the balance of it. What makes it unique?
Generally, a carving knife of today is made about 8 to 10 inches long. It has a relatively thin blade, both in the thickness of the steel that it's made out of and the width of the blade.
Okay.
It also has a point. You see some slicing knives that are rounded on the end. They're not ideal for carving meat. You definitely need a point to work around joints or cut off legs of turkeys, for example, and things like that.
Okay. And a carver can be used for carving any meat. There's not a specific turkey carver, right?
Not today. I mean, carvers today are designed for cutting generally any meat. Back in the Middle Ages, they made many different carvers for cutting many different kinds of foods. But today, we've kind of averaged it all out to one style.
So they've had different knives for different meats at different times.
Yes.
Interesting. Now, Corey, let me ask you, we've been a meat-eating species for as long as we've been a species. When did the knife really start coming into play, the carver?
Well, the real heyday of the carving knife was in the European Middle Ages, right on up through the Victorian Age.
Mm-hmm.
In those times, you know, it was only the very wealthy who could afford to eat large pieces of meat. And so sitting at the table and carving meat for your guests was really a symbol of wealth and sophistication. And I recently read a book called Honors of the Table. It was written in 1791 to teach young people about proper manners while dining, and fully a third of the book was dedicated to the art of carving meats.
Seriously?
Yep.
What are some of the points, the most salient points from back then?
From back then? Let's see here. So a list of rules of carving at the table from 1790 are: there was to be no standing while carving was done. Instead, hosts around the land were advised to invest in a seat lofty enough to allow them to wield their blades from a commanding position.
Oh, my.
Under no circumstances should the head of the household keep the best bits of turkey for themselves. And favoritism when handing out the choice cuts was always frowned upon, unless, of course, a person of superior rank happened to be gracing the table. And then the final one, which I think still applies today: we should not cut the slices too thick or too thin and should help our friends to gravy. It is also generally best to ask our friends what part they like the best.
Light or dark.
That's right.
And so talking about asking friends what they would like, light or dark, and cutting thin slices, the question that comes up every year is, how do you slice a turkey properly?
Well, the method that virtually every chef I've ever seen or talked to about it is generally the same. So the first step is to remove the legs, you know, including the thigh and the wings. And that's best done by getting a good purchase on the end of the wing or the end of the leg and moving it around so you can really see where that joint is that meets the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then just taking the knife and kind of working around that joint and moving it at the same time until you cut through all the meat that's there, the ligaments. That doesn't sound very appetizing, but I think we know what we mean. And then so once you've pulled off the wings and the legs, then the next thing to do is to remove the breasts. So it's really just done in two parts, the breast on each side. And what you want to do is take the tip of the knife and cut down between the sternum and the meat, and use your knife to stay as close to the bone as you can, kind of tracing down the side of the sternum.
Mm-hmm.
Until if you can reach all the way down on that side with your knife and get the whole breast off, that's great. But a lot of times you have to actually cut as far as you can down that way and then go under the bird and cut the breast off from the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you've got that done, then you take the whole breast off of the carcass, put it on a cutting board, and then slice it. And again, what I see most chefs doing is slicing across the grain of the meat. So if you were thinking of the breast as running from the head to the tail, you want to slice perpendicularly
like
to that.
A football, and you slice it across the football.
Exactly, yes. Right. And then you'll have the most kind of tenderest bites that way.
And Corey, if someone's in the market to buy the perfect carver, what should they look for?
Well, really, a lot of the things that we talked about before, 8 to 10 inches long, a thin blade, both in width and thickness. Mm-hmm. The thing that I didn't mention before that I think is very important is it should be made out of high-quality cutlery steel. A lot of times I've seen carving sets that are made out of either very stainless flatware steel or even silver that are designed to be decorative, but they're you can't really sharpen them and they don't hold an edge. And then the last idea I have for you is I've many times seen at antique shops these grand carving sets from latter years. Mm. A lot of times they have an antler handle with silver bolsters on it, and they're just super cool. And I think if you're embracing that tradition of the days gone by of carving, I think those are a great choice. Now, one comment I would remind folks of is those knives usually are made of what we call carbon steel, mm-hmm. which is great for edge holding and sharpening, but it's not stain resistant. So you need to keep a little extra care with those. Make sure you wash them and dry them after you use them.
So after the holidays are done, Thanksgiving, Christmas, everything, we're past the new year, how do you store this carver that you bought, maybe with antlers on it? How do you store it?
Well, that antler one particularly, and especially if it's an older carbon steel, but even if it's made out of a modern stainless steel, if it's going to sit unused for a long period of time, I think it's really important to put some oil on it. Mm-hmm. So because we're in the kitchen, the easiest thing to do is just use some vegetable oil or mineral oil. Really, anything but olive oil is fine. And rub the whole blade, and I think it's best just to rub the handle and every part of it. And then usually those things come in cases, so those are easy to store in. If not, wrapping it up in a towel is nice to protect the knife and the edge while it's being stored. But I do have one idea for you, and that is if you've got it, mm-hmm. you might as well use it.
Flaunt it.
Yeah, so anytime you're cutting up meat, get it out, show it off a little bit. Just put it in your knife block, and I think you'll find lots of times there's great applications for it.
Well, hopefully that neglected child will become the favorite child after a while.
That's right.
Corey, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much.
You too. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
David Leet heads up leetsculinaria.com. Corey Milligan is the founder of New West Knifeworks. Well, stay with us. We're going to be back with your calls and questions in a moment. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said it looks like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
We're connecting with you. Now, you can pick up the phone, call us at 800-537-5252, connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Just go to the website. Okay, let's get started with Katie from New York. Katie, what do you want to talk about?
My turkey, when it's done and everyone's eaten it, what am I supposed to do with the turkey carcass? It feels like a waste to just toss it. So
oh,
I was wondering
no.
I can repurpose it and give it new life.
Well, there's a lot of things you could do with. I mean, you can never throw away that. I mean, that's just the most delicious makings for a broth. But this is the thing that I love to do with it. Okay, first of all, try to get it in the fridge as quickly as you can. You know, I don't mean leap up from the table in the middle of dinner, but you don't want it to start going off. So get it into the refrigerator. And then what you're going to do the next day is take a fairly good sized pot, and you want to chop up a couple of onions, a couple of carrots, a couple of stalks of celery, a whole head of garlic, because it never hurts. Pour about a half a bottle of white wine into the pot. Then take the carcass, break it up if you can, you know, but just get it all in there with any bits and pieces of meat, you know, like the neck, the wingtips, all of that kind of thing. And then cover that with about an inch of water and bring it very slowly to just a bubble where every you could count to five between when the bubbles, you know, surface and go blup. And you want to do a really slow simmer on that for about 4 or 5 hours. If you want to, you could leave it on for 6 or 7 hours. The more you do, the more, you know, you're going to eke out an awful lot of the goodness of that turkey carcass. And you want to have the pot partially covered. You want to always have that carcass covered by, you know, an inch of water. And once it's done, you know, once you've simmered it, you then can just strain it. You could even use a slotted spoon and lift out all the solids and get this chilled down. It may mean putting it, you know, out on a terrace. It may mean putting it in the fridge, but you want to chill it down. And if there's any fat at all, you'll be able to just skim it off. It'll just firm up. And then you have a broth, and you could put tortellini in that broth, and you have a delicious soup. You could put vegetables in that broth. And it's fabulous. So that's what you do with the turkey carcass.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. And by the way, the name for that in our family was skeleton soup.
Oh.
Okay.
That sounds like a fantastic idea. Thank you.
Give it a shot. Hey, and thank you for calling. Have a great holiday.
You too. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And by the way, this business about the carcass, if you're really pooped, you know, the dinner's over, etc., just put it in a plastic bag and put it in the freezer. And then whenever you want to get to it, you get to it. But this is the makings of fabulous broth. All that deliciousness. And any pan drippings you can get in there, that should go in too. Okay, Daniel is up next, and he's calling from San Diego. Daniel, what's up? What is on your mind?
Ever since I sort of got into cooking a couple years ago, I've been trying to do some sort of interesting dish, something a little bit different for the family.
Right.
At Thanksgiving time. Like, I've made a couple different pies, and last year I made a winter root vegetable gratin, which was interesting, wasn't the best.
isn't that word interesting, a nice one to use?
It is, it's perfect. But I was curious if you had any suggestions for a side dish that was either something that we don't do or like a really interesting twist on a normal dish.
What pops into my mind, and I have no idea where this is going to go, is onions. That, I mean, there's the standard little onions, you know, that are made in a cream sauce kind of thing, which a lot of people like. But I'm thinking about the fact that nobody thinks of onions as a vegetable. They think of it as an ingredient, you know, and something that adds to something else. And I'm just wondering what would happen if you did sort of a casserole. I'm thinking of that gratin idea.
Yes.
I wonder what would happen if you did something like a Yukon potato, and the potato would be the minor ingredient. The onion and garlic would be the main ingredients. And I'm just making this up in my head, Daniel, but I'm just thinking this could really be delicious, where if you took onions, you could do this in the food processor with the slicing blade.
Okay.
You know, slice them so they're like a quarter inch thick, even a half inch thick. Okay. And then you would slice something like Yukon Golds or Redskin potatoes, more or less that same thickness. And you would toss the onions with a little bit of olive oil and maybe some balsamic vinegar or sherry vinegar, you know, something that has a vinegar that's acidic and has a bit of flavor to it.
Okay.
And fresh herbs. So that could be sage, rosemary, basil, and throw in some lemon rind. And then thin sliced garlic, too.
Okay.
Toss that together. And then what you would do is you'd take a shallow baking dish, the kind of thing that you use for the root vegetable gratin.
Yes.
And you'd put in at the bottom of the dish, you'd rub the dish with a good amount of olive oil or butter, and then you'd put in a layer of the onions that's about, a half inch thick or more. Then overlap potatoes, you know, like they're fanned out on top of it. Sprinkle everything with salt and pepper and a little nutmeg. Nutmeg's good with this kind of thing.
Okay.
And then
do another thick layer of onion, and then another thin layer of potato, another layer of onion, and end with the potato.
Okay.
You know, and overlap it so it looks pretty. And season each layer. And then what you could do is pour in some half and half or cream or a mixture of half and half with a really delicious homemade broth. Seal that, okay, you know, with foil and put it in an oven and slow bake it at about 325 or 350. And do that until the when you pierce, you know, take the foil off and you pierce the potatoes, they're starting to really get softer, okay? And then uncover it and just let it bake.
Okay.
And the idea is that you don't want to cover everything completely, but you want to have everything get absorbed, absorbing that liquid. And if you want to, you can then grate cheese on top of that and finish it off with cheese. But you could do it ahead and then just do the cheese when you heat it up.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, and the only thing is it may be a little soupy. That's the only thing about it that may be a bit of a catch. But ideally, the potatoes will absorb a fair amount of liquid.
Okay.
But you see what I'm saying is you want those onions to just melt down.
Yeah.
And you could have other stuff in there. I mean, you could have some olives in there. You could have a few capers in there. You're going sort of for a Mediterranean / Central France feel.
Okay.
And see what happens. I think that could really be delicious.
No, it would be something different. Something,
yeah. I think
give it a try.
Yeah, see what happens.
Cool, I'll have to do that.
All right, take a shot at it. See what you think.
Perfect. Thanks, Lynn.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Bye. Call us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Emily's on the line from Wichita, Kansas. Emily, what do you want to talk about?
Well, thank you so much for taking my call.
I kind of have
a silly endeavor. I'm almost embarrassed to come to you with it because it's it's something that's been in my family for literally decades, 3 or 4 decades. And every year, somebody different brings it to our Thanksgiving or Christmas, Easter, any sort of family event. And this year, I'm bringing it. And no. I absolutely hate it.
What is it? I'm dying to know.
Okay, so there are only 4 ingredients, although sometimes people play with it a little. But the 4 ingredients are Cool Whip or whipped cream,
right?
Cottage cheese, orange Jell-O packets, and mandarin oranges or regular oranges or tangerines.
Is this like an ambrosia?
It's not that sophisticated.
What does it look like? What's done with it?
It's like a cold, it looks sort of like something you might find at a deli. It's served cold. You just spoon it onto a plate. Sometimes you can dip oranges into it or carrots or something like that.
It's a mold.
Yeah, sort of like that. But the Jell-O is not meant to harden. It's just the sugar sort of crystallizes in the Cool Whip and it's put on top.
You know, don't be embarrassed.
Well,
this is a family tradition.
It is, but the thing with my family is because I'm doing it this year, I'm sort of a foodie. You know, I work in the kitchen. I love cooking. And so I refuse to bring it in this condition this year. But my family is very, very traditional. And like last year, for instance, I brought a cream corn, which we bring every year, but I decided to put fresh mint in it and use 2 different kinds of corn.
Yeah.
And when I said that there was mint, nobody wanted it because they had never had that before. They had said if it was parsley, well, maybe we would do it if it was parsley, but they didn't want to do mint. So I can't go too far out of their boundaries. I was wanting to do maybe like a mousse or something or an ambrosia, but I don't know if they would go for that.
You know, Emily, I know exactly what you mean. You know that line, been there, done that? Because I come from a very traditional Italian family, and everybody thought they were game to try, you know, all the stuff I started experimenting with. But they weren't. They weren't comfortable. And it's that kind of thing of, you know, I mean, you see when people are torn between, I don't want to make her unhappy, but I don't like this, you know, that kind of thing. You know what it sounds like? I have to say, this sounds like one of those things where you really don't, if you listen to how it's made, you know, it's very fashionable to say, oh dear, no, I would never eat that.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
Somebody puts it on a plate and doesn't say a word of what it is, and you find you're scarfing it up and, you know, you're thinking, should I ask for a second? You know, go with the tradition.
Why make an issue out of it? You've got, what, 364 other days of the year to do whatever
right.
you want. And you like it. You know you like it. Everybody
yeah,
else
I do.
Is going to like it. And who cares if we upgrade or we don't upgrade?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
Hey, yeah. And happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
You know, it's hard to mess with tradition. A while back, we tried something. We had a newspaper writer here in town who claimed that you could not make anything better than the famous green bean casserole, you know, with everything from a can, right? Well, I tried to make, in quotes, a green bean casserole with real food. And we put the two recipes up on the website. And guess what? Listeners couldn't stand my version. Fancy caramelized onions and a homemade sauce and all that fancy stuff. Stay with the traditions. There is a lovely collection of food poetry. Now, the next time you need a toast at a dinner, I suggest that you reach for this book. Award-winning poet Kevin Young joins us with his anthology that he calls The Hungry Ear, Poems of Food and Drink. Kevin, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
When did you write your first food poem?
Gosh,
do you remember?
I used to joke that all my poems were about food and hair, so probably pretty young. But, you know, the first odes I wrote to sort of the food of my childhood, which was Southern food, even though we didn't live in the South anymore. My family was from Louisiana, and that's really what we ate. But when my father passed away, that was a way to sort of talk about comfort, to talk about memory and that place where food and thinking of the past and connecting to the past with just a simple meal happens. And I think poetry captures that more than anything. For me, those poems that I first started writing were about hunger in some sense, this desire to be connected to him and connected to this ancestral home. And I think a lot of people feel that, especially on Thanksgiving.
You know, it's interesting you say this, just to take us on an aside, but I learned that in Thailand, traditionally, when someone dies, there is always a funeral book that evidently commemorates their lives, and often it will have recipes of the dishes that they love. And this
wow.
is the way a lot of people research the food of their culture, is by these very old funeral books.
Wow.
But coming back to now... Give me back to now. Is there a particular poem in the book that you think is just right for this holiday?
Well, there's many. I mean, I think food is ritual. It is a way of, as you mentioned, connecting us to the past. But I love the poem First Thanksgiving by Sharon Olds.
Oh, could you read it for us?
Yes. First Thanksgiving. When she comes back from college, I will see the skin of her upper arms cool, matte, glossy. She will hug me, my old soupy chest against her breasts. I will smell her hair. She will sleep in this apartment, her sleep like an untamed good object, like a soul in a body. She came into my life the second great arrival, fresh from the other world, which lay from within him, within me. Those nights I fed her to sleep week after week, the moon rising and setting and waxing, whirling over the months in a steady blur around our planet. Now she doesn't need love like that. She has had it. She will walk in glowing. We will talk. And then when she's fast asleep, I'll exult to have her in that room again, behind that door. As a child, I caught bees by the wings and held them some seconds, looked into their wild faces, listened to them sing, then tossed them back into the air. I remember the moment the arc of my toss swerved and they entered the corrected curve of their departure.
Kevin, that was perfect. That was just perfect. Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Take good care.
Poet Kevin Young was awarded the Patterson Poetry Prize for sustained literary achievement. The poem that he read was First Thanksgiving by Sharon Olds from his anthology, The Hungry Ear, Poems of Food and Drink. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Dom DeLillo, who said, "It occurred to me that eating is the only form of professionalism most people ever attain." Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. And don't miss the newest edition of our ebook. This one is Italian Holidays, Eating In with Lynn. It's a full-fledged menu designed to get you from Thanksgiving to the New Year. I'm going to teach you how to eat Italian. There's a collection of antipasti, pasta, main dishes, and show-stopping desserts. Everyone is going to be satisfied, from carnivores to vegans. And speaking of menus, this year we've partnered with The Kitchen, and they've offered their own Thanksgiving menu. It's called a small and swanky Thanksgiving dinner. And it's all there at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz with help from Laura Kalibi. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, we're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.